from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's forum, loneliness can cause emotional suffering to people of all ages. But a new study by University of California San Francisco researchers, which focused on the question of loneliness and its effects, suggests it's especially harmful to the elderly and raises the risk of health problems, even premature death. We'll talk about the findings. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. The elderly population of those over the age of 65 in the United States continues to grow and is expected to reach 88.5 million by 2050. And a new study of some 1,600 seniors by University of California San Francisco researchers was published just yesterday in the Archives of Internal Medicine supporting the link between loneliness and failing health or death in the elderly. We want to focus our attention in this opening forum hour on that study and its significance to the elderly population, which will include, inevitably, many of you who are listening who are not part of it now. Carla Parisinotto is with us in studio. She's an assistant clinical professor in the Division of Geriatrics at UCSF and the lead author of the study. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Karen Scaltetti with us, who is Director of Clinical and Community Services with Institute on Aging and who is a psychologist, and welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you both here. Dr. Parisinotto, let me begin with you, and let's begin by just talking about the fact that there are, from your research, serious health consequences, including death, linked to loneliness. Loneliness is often a subjective kind of thing. How do you measure loneliness? How do you quantify it?
You know, that's a very important part, and one of the key points of the study is that it is something that is subjective. It is not just looking at how many contacts someone has or how many people around them, but it really is a subjective feeling of loneliness. And the way we measured it is by using three questions. We asked people if they felt left out. We asked if they felt isolated, or if they lacked companionship. And if they answered that they felt any of these things some of the time or often, they were classified as being lonely.
About half of them were classified as being lonely, but about 18% live alone?
Absolutely.
So you can be lonely and have all kinds of companionship, partners, husbands, wives, and that's certainly something we learned from this. In fact, two-thirds are married or living with a partner, roughly.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
But usually with typical medical models, you don't include a subjective feelings that affect health, do you?
No, not at all. It's something that dates back into how we are trained as medical professionals, is that we try to focus much more on concrete data, so to speak. And though we may sometimes ask about this, we relegate it almost to a second class and don't put it as the primary focus of our examination or our interaction with patients.
Do you separate, and I presume you do, loneliness from depression?
I absolutely do. I think when I was looking into this this research question, it wasn't exactly clear how it was going to play out, as certainly there are some overlapping symptoms. But it has become much more clear in the study that they are different entities. For example, depression is usually associated with a lack of enjoyment, a lack of energy or motivation, but these factors aren't necessarily part of a loneliness.
Trace this idea of loneliness or this sensibility of being lonely to biological things like stress or stress-related hormones? I mean, there has been talk about blood pressure rising, and I think there was, in fact, a study out of Cornell. Anthony Ong did this mm-hmm. study. Are we talking about biology here? Are we also talking about, or to what extent are we talking about behavior, where people don't have someone who can get medication for them or who can help them or can give them support?
You're asking the key questions, and my study didn't delve into causality, but it's certainly something that is of interest of us to try to understand. Likely, as in many disease models, it is a combination of these things, is that there have been studies looking at the biological physiological mechanisms, exactly as you say, whether it's a stress response, a change in immune function that leads to these outcomes. But absolutely, as a clinician and as someone who has background in anthropology, I firmly believe in the behavioral mechanisms underlying it.
Carla Parasenato, again, is assistant clinical professor in the Division of Geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and lead author in the study that we're focusing on this hour. Karen Scaltetti is director of clinical and community services with the Institute on Aging, and as a psychologist, she works mainly with adults who are at homebound, yeah?
That's right. Yeah, the Institute on Aging really tries to serve people in their homes. We found that it's difficult for people to come in and receive services, although we will do that as well. And so we've created a lot of our services so that we go out and meet with people. And I think one of the things that Carla's getting at that she's bringing up is the fact that, once people start to feel lonely, they start to do less. And as you do less, you become more lonely. And this can be a really vicious cycle where the feelings begin and lead to certain behaviors, which then lead to more of those feelings, which then bring these health issues to play. And so it can be a pretty fast building cycle. And so it's really important for us to get into the home to try and get in the way of that and start things going the other direction.
Well, let's talk about how you do that. But yeah. First, you meet a lot of lonely people, I presume. I mean, this study backs up what you have observed and what you have experienced.
Absolutely. And it really captures the fact that there were some early studies in geriatrics that really talked about friendship being related to well-being. And everybody thought, oh, the people with the most friends will rate their well-being as the best. And what we found instead is that it was really about the quality of the friendships that you had, not the quantity of the friendships. And this study just fits right into that, in that, you know, people can be surrounded by other people in their lives, but if they feel like they're not connecting to those people, then they have this loneliness that is a really important clinical thing that's going on. So the study, I'm so grateful to the work that they've done here, because it really does highlight something that we see all the time in clinical work.
You can't necessarily push people into closer, more intimate relations with others that they know, their friends or whatever, but you can provide them with things that can engage them. And I think that's really what we're talking about here, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And, you know, you can engage people in lots of ways. I mean, we provide home care for people, and it may be that the home care provider is helping someone with their medication, but the kind of discussion that they may be having while they're doing that task, the way that they're delivering the service, whatever the service is going to make the difference in what the connection is like, much more than what the specific service might be in and of itself. We do home visit psychotherapy. Obviously, that's exploring all kinds of things going on in people's lives. But sometimes it can be the home care worker who's going in doing, you know, household tasks with someone, but really having quality discussion and interaction about where the person is at their life that ends up making the difference.
But let's be candid about this. I mean, psychologically, yeah. Often it's the desolation of old age. I mean, you have children, you raise children, maybe you have a mate, that mate is gone. You have work, the work is gone, and you're left alone. And you're really, in some ways, not given the kind of attention and compassion that every human being, and particularly people who have lived full and important lives, deserve.
That's right. I mean, this isn't just a problem about the people that were studied in the research study. This is a problem about our society and the way that we treat people.
The way we shuffle off old people,
that's
really,
exactly
and warehouse
right.
them.
Yeah. We forget that we're all going to, hopefully, be a part of this group.
Well,
at some point.
The baby boomers particularly. And Dr. Parasenato, this gets right into the question of what healthcare professionals need to know from this study. And they need to presumably perhaps ask more their patients what they're suffering from in the way of loneliness or what they're experiencing, yes?
That is exactly what I was hoping that this study would accomplish. And for one, having a forum like this to discuss this and have more people be aware of it so that two things can happen. One, people who are receiving medical care can identify this as a risk factor and can start to talk more openly about it. And absolutely, for healthcare providers and future healthcare providers whom we train at UCSF, start to pay more attention to this.
Does that mean screening more too?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So including this in one of the routine parts of screening. And I believe what my colleague here said is that as part of one of their programs at the Institute on Aging, they already are using the loneliness questionnaires. A screen.
That's right. Yeah, we have a friendship line that's a free 24-hour hotline that's available to older adults. It was originally created to help prevent suicide in the elderly, but it's also become really one of the main ways that older adults in San Francisco and across the state can call in and have some contact with someone. And so one of the measures that we're capturing now on that line is loneliness, because we found that it's so important. It may be more important than us capturing depression when people are calling in.
Well, if we sound like we're highlighting the importance of loneliness, the answer is definitely yes. And what I'd like to do is really invite those of you listening to join us. The subtext of this is people who are isolated, who lack companionship, who feel lonely, really need to be more visible and need to be given attention, and ought to be given attention, whether you're family members or just people you see in the supermarket or in your neighborhood. I'm going to give out a phone number, and I know there are many of you who would like to weigh in on this subject, and this is an opportunity to do that. Those of you perhaps who are have experienced a sense of loneliness, and you don't have to necessarily be elderly, but we're talking about, of course, the elderly. Loneliness afflicts those of all ages, but how does it happen to afflict you or your loved ones, your parents, for example? And what do you think needs to be done? And are we talking about really something of serious concern for not only health professionals, but for society in general? Feel free to join the program. You can do that now at our toll-free number. It's available to you whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, and we do invite your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, toll-free now. 866-733-6786. Let me tell you some other ways you can communicate with us, your thoughts or your concerns or any questions you might have about loneliness in later years. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. Again, the toll-free number is available, 866-733-6786. And we're talking also about social support here, I think, aren't we? Let me go to you, Karen Scaletti, on this. That is the idea that actually you can improve health and expand lifespans and affect them by providing more social support.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we see people who come into our programs, all different kinds of programs, case management, therapy, health services, and we'll see them come in very poor health, often not complying with the medical recommendations that are being given to them, which I'm sure my colleague can talk more about, and just starting to have contact with someone, just starting to feel like there's someone out there who's caring, who's paying attention, who's treating you as someone who's important and valued in the world, can start to make small behavioral changes. Maybe you take those medications that you haven't been taking. Maybe you show up for that doctor's appointment, and that combination of behavior and that feeling of someone starting to pay attention and notice can really make a difference. We see people 6 months later look totally different in terms of their mental and their physical health.
And talk a little more about this friendship line, because that's at least a way that people can speak to someone who is sympathetic and at least listening. And listening, of course, is so important here. How many people do you have working on that?
The amazing thing about the friendship line, there are lots of amazing things about it, but it's absolutely volunteer primarily run. We have staff who help train and provide really in-depth, amazing training. Patrick Arbor is the founder of the friendship line and began this a while ago. And we have a volunteer corps of about 40, I think, at this point. We've always got 3 or 4 volunteers working, including 2 who work all throughout the night. And people call in. They can call in, and we can also set up.
Might as well give the number, by the way, because, I mean, people are calling in now, and we're going to talk with
sure.
our listeners in just a moment. But
I think the easiest way is actually to call the general information line for the Institute on Aging, because it's super easy to remember, which is 750-4111, and they can connect you directly to the friendship line number from there, and also talk about other services that we may have that are available to you. So that's the easiest way to get to us and to the friendship line, is to call 750-4111. We made it easy to remember.
And we're going to go to our lines in just a moment, but I just want to ask Carla Perisinotto, I mean, this may be a little bit out of the purview of your study, but what about, there's a lot of talk about how maybe older people can be comforted by pets, or they can be comforted by perhaps at least in some way associating more with young people. I mean, there are lots of things that play into this, at least anecdotally or antidotally.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point, and you're right. It is not something that we study directly, but this is the kind of information and further research that we're looking to get into, is to try to understand the depth of relationships, the importance of feeling that you're valued. And that is something that, again, it's not captured just by the number of relationships, but the type of relationships. And if someone can find just as meaningful of a relation with a pet, then that is fantastic, and mm-hmm. that is something that we should support. Mm-hmm. And I should also clarify that though I am the lead author in this study, I am primarily a clinician. And so I, like my colleagues, see many older adults who are feeling lonely in my practice and when I see people at home, as I also do house calls.
Of course, sometimes it's difficult to draw that. I mean, for a psychologist or for a medical doctor, to draw that sense out of them that, yes, I feel lonely. I mean, especially older people who have a kind of stoic attitude that they're not supposed to express their emotions or their viscera, and they're not supposed to let them loose, or...
You know, interestingly enough, I have seen it come out more often than not, just the patients themselves telling me. And there are other ways that indirectly what they're telling me, I can hear it, I can mm-hmm. I can interpret what they're saying, and I understand what
they're saying. Is there sometimes shame associated with it, though, and feelings of embarrassment?
The shame and embarrassment associated with it is more with the loss of independence and the fear of losing independence, the fear that they are feeling alone because they are stuck at home and unable to get out. And that is something that's shameful. And that's what we work with and talk about. Well, let's talk about ways that we can work on getting you outside of the home, which is whether it's relying on organizations such as the Institute on Aging to provide more resources, whether it's looking for philanthropic support to, for example, a patient of mine who is homebound because of stairs and looking for ways for her to get a ramp to get out of her home. And there's different ways to then talk about.
It's a huge problem in San Francisco. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, it is, especially in San Francisco. But you think about it, these people who are very independent and autonomous, and then suddenly they become in more ways helpless. And that means often not being able to drive a vehicle and not mm-hmm. being able to be mobile. Mm-hmm. And they're not living the life that they were living before. And it's mm-hmm. a new kind of life to adjust to. It's an enormous adjustment.
Mm-hmm. It is, but we cannot assume that who we think will be lonely will be lonely. I'll give you an example. As through my house calls practice, I did visit a patient of mine who is homebound and bedbound. And I thought, aha, I'm sure she's lonely.
Yeah.
And I asked, and she's absolutely not lonely. and in contrast, I have patients who are quite social and come to see me. And one of their biggest complaints is this desperation, this complete distress of feeling lonely despite being surrounded by so many people.
Which means in many cases, we use a psychological term, they want to repress those feelings. Mm-hmm. That's really what I was getting at here. Mm-hmm. Let me get to our callers, and we'll bring in a caller. Jamie, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a physician in the Bay Area, and I was interested in the loneliness study. Is there a validated questionnaire that you use that would be available to use in my practice? I see definitely a lot of patients with loneliness, but sometimes I have a hard time figuring out whether it's truly depression or loneliness.
Sure. So absolutely.
Carla Parisonoto.
This is Carla Parisonoto speaking. There is a validated questionnaire, and it is the questionnaire that we used in our study. One of the things that I do like about it is that it is useful for physicians like you because it's quick and it's easy to administer. It's not copyrighted. And so it's asking three items. It's asking an individual if they feel left out, if they feel isolated, and if they lack companionship. And someone is asked if they never feel this, if they feel this sometimes or often. And the way we categorized it, you could certainly use this as a high to low score, but actually if you responded yes to any of these questions, it actually already has a significant impact.
Is that available on a website, or is it available to physicians who might want to access?
You know, it's interesting because it's so far it's been used in research. It's not mm-hmm. as a distinct entity, but it is very easy to write up.
Well, you could get it in the Archives of Internal Medicine.
Absolutely.
Just go
yes.
on. Yeah.
I also think that it's important to never,
Karen Scaltetti.
Screens are always useful and helpful, and they should never replace our just good ability to have a conversation with a client. And And to just ask the question, to say, are you lonely? Is that something that's going on? There were some funny depression studies that were done at one point that looked at all these screens that had been developed and then found that the question, are you depressed, got the answer just as well as a lot of the screening measures that we had developed. So obviously these screening measures help. They help us remind us to get at this information. But nothing substitutes real good conversation with someone and just being able to be honest. And that's some of the quality of relationship that people are looking for.
And make it human, you know,
absolutely.
Sincere and not just, are you lonely looking down at the, well, let me go to more of our callers and we'll get a caller in from Oakland. Lori, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that my partner's a gerontologist and she's studying a new theory. It's called reminiscence theory or validation therapy. And it works with elders of all ages from communicative to non-communicative. And basically you're connecting with them on the sensory, tactile, and other kinds of nonverbal ways. And it's a thing that she does on a continuous basis, weekly, and that kind of thing. And it provides another kind of connection that we might not think about in terms of just having a conversation. So I just wanted to mention that.
Well, I think both of my guests are familiar with this, nodding their heads. What can you add to this, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about reminiscence therapy, too, is that we can use it with folks who have memory impairment or dementia, because long-term memories stay around even if you're having difficulties with short-term memory. So we're able to engage someone who may not be able to remember day-to-day what's happening with stories about what happened to them 30 and 40 years ago and what were the valuable experiences from their lives. So it's been a tremendously powerful form of therapy that's been used across the older adult.
I just saw some new research, and I don't know if either of you know about this, that says if dementia doesn't start setting in, there's suddenly new and illuminating research suggesting that cognitive powers can actually in some cases not be impaired but increase as age goes on. I was quite heartened to read this, I must say. I said, it should only be true about the body as well, but, you know, that the brain in many cases is quite an adaptable and resilient organ and can become stronger as you get older. It was quite heartening.
That's exactly right. Engagement is a key in terms of cognitive functioning. How much we're engaging our brain makes a huge, huge difference.
Absolutely.
We get another caller on here, and we'll go to Burlingame. Casey, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I went and took care of my grandmother when I was about 22 or 25 or somewhere in there, and she had terminal cancer, and it was great to have a visitor for her. I lived in another state. I moved to Phoenix, Arizona to live with her, and with all of our college grads that can't find jobs, I think that'd be an excellent way for them to spend their time.
Casey, you're a hero to me. I mean, people who do that work really deserve big kudos, because it's tough work, I mean, caregiving. What about the idea of maybe, I mean, I kept talking about youthful connections and people feeling, I mean, there are a lot of these sorts of things where you have surrogate grandmothers and grandfathers and all of that sort of thing. But maybe we need more of those, a lot more of those.
I think that would be a great point. And there have been some smaller programs looking into this. There's a small program with UC Berkeley that has partnered with one of the areas where I work in, which is the Lifelong Medical Center and Over 60 Health Center in Berkeley, where we did have some college students do friendly visits to some of our homebound patients. And it is an amazing program. How do we keep it going and how do we get more people into it? It's by talking about it on air. And it is something that, for example, with one of my patients who is homebound and is feeling lonely and told me straight out that that is why she's losing weight, because she doesn't enjoy meals because they're not social anymore. And we talked about how can she get more involved with...
Well, what about Meals on Wheels? And I mean, there are programs like that.
There are programs. Meals on Wheels is a fantastic program that provides food for homebound seniors, but is not the companionship. It is not really someone coming and sitting with you. It's someone delivering meals. So it does accomplish many things that seniors need, but not exactly the companionship.
So we need a lot more, well, volunteer work out there and volunteers available and organizations that will attract those volunteers. And again, we're talking about loneliness and emotional suffering, well, people of all ages, but a new study out of UCSF focusing on the question of loneliness and its effects and suggesting it's especially harmful to the elderly and raises the risk of health problems and even premature death. We're talking with the lead researcher, Carla Parisinoto, who's here with us in studio, assistant clinical professor in the Division of Geriatrics at UCSF and lead author on the study, and Karen Skull Teddy, who's also with us, a psychologist and director of clinical and community services for the Institute on Aging. And we'll hear from more of you when we return. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. You're listening to Forum on Public Radio KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a new research study out of the University of California, San Francisco, which was published yesterday in the Archives of Internal Medicine. The lead author is with us in studio, Dr. Carla Parisinoto, who is assistant clinical professor in geriatrics at UCSF. And Karen Skulteddy is also with us, a psychologist who directs the clinical community services for the Institute on Aging, and talking about how this recent study shows a link between loneliness and impairment of health, and also earlier or more premature death as a result of loneliness. Here's a web comment that asks, have your guests seen differences between loneliness in men and women? It said that men left alone die quickly, but not women.
That's an interesting question. So in our study, there were actually more women who reported feeling lonely. So there was a gender difference there.
More depression among women and elderly, too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so, but the question in terms of men dying sooner, that's thought to be a little bit more biologic. And there are some interesting statistics in terms of when a spouse dies and how the other partner quickly often dies soonly after.
Mm-hmm. Listener writes, I understand. I'm in my mid-60s. I am blind. My circle is small, and I am increasingly isolated. My best friends are my dog guides. I don't know how long I will live. Life for me is not rich, nor is it full. This is what you hear a lot. And, you know, your heart cries out to want to do something or want to reach out or want to connect these people with other human beings.
And it is with that person writing in, the question is how connected does he or she feel with their physician, and are they being listened to? Is their physician aware of what programs are out there for people? Because the chances are he or she is not alone, and there are other people like him or her, mm-hmm. and there are ways for us to help.
We're talking about a bigger subject here, really, for physicians as well as, for that matter, healthcare workers of all kind. I would include psychologists. To one of my heroic figures in this is Abraham Verghese down at Stanford, who talks about the necessity of making closer contact with patients, even touching them, although that's a taboo and that's mm-hmm. dangerous and mm-hmm. people immediately get their sensors all up and so forth. But that realization that you're talking to a human being and extending your own humanity as much as you can and your respect to that other human being, I mean, it's key. Here's Elizabeth, who says, with my father and increasingly with my husband, I have witnessed how deteriorating hearing leads to feeling isolated, even in a group. People want to interact with others, but finally give up when they just can't hear and keep up. And absolutely right. I saw it with both my parents. When their hearing started to deteriorate, they were out of it more. They couldn't listen, and then they just did kind of
such an important part, the sensory impairments that clearly lead to social isolation and feelings of loneliness. I think, again, there we are remiss in medical practice of recognizing this and recognizing the impact it has on someone's life. But again, there are amazingly ways to adapt this. There's something called a pocket talker, which you can have in your clinic office, or you can actually purchase online on Amazon that provides some way of amplifying if you can't afford hearing aids. I also have another patient that, though not ideal, she does communicate by writing on a board. And so there are ways to get around it. Is it ideal? Is it perfect? Absolutely not.
Let me read a couple more comments. This is from John, who is age 68, and he says, some of the responsibility for this belongs to the elderly themselves. There is presently a huge need for volunteer activity in so many areas of our society. Why don't the elderly get out of their rocking chairs and help tutor young people, for example? Hopefully the boomer generation will turn society's picture of aging and retirement upside down. Sometimes, of course, they can't get out of the rocking chair, but I understand the sentiment. A comment on our website.
Right. And we don't do a good job necessarily letting them know that we would value. If you don't feel like society is valuing you in general, the idea that you would sign up to be a volunteer and people would be excited about it is hard to get to if the message we're sending is that we're not interested in interacting with you in the first place. We're setting people up to not want to necessarily easily do that.
Sometimes they need a little push, too. You know, yeah. These services are out there and they need you, right?
Right.
They would like you to participate. Here's a web comment. Is it just the old who are lonely? I've always heard young people complaining they feel lonely, even when surrounded by peers. They can harbor deep grudges against types of people whom they assume receive more attention. If all age groups are lonely, could the problem actually be that our culture suffers from a defect, like the obsession with making and spending money? Some immigrants refer to this as being plastico. To me, it's just an avoidance. It's just an avoidance of life. The deliberate non-examination of life, rendering most interactions as meaningless.
I mean, I think the idea that this is and this is one of the ideas we should try and get in our society, is that these are lifespan problems, as opposed to they just show up magically when we turn old, is a really important one. You know, we can't go back and ask all of these people, unfortunately, unless somebody gives Carla a $2 million grant or something like that. We can't go back and ask all of them, were you lonely your whole life? But it's interesting to think about whether this is a lifetime accumulation of someone who felt lonely. This is a lifetime accumulation. And then it shows up as our body starts to get older and things not start to work. Then we start to see maybe the health problems. But maybe these are people who have been lonely a long time. And again, the quantity of connection is not what matters. I don't think 500 Facebook friends will keep you from feeling lonely.
May make you feel more lonely.
Exactly.
Are you both maybe too young to know the name Roy Orbison? Only the lonely know why I cry.
Name.
Only the lonely. Well, he's singing to mainly a teen demographic, probably. You know,
that's right.
Loneliness is certainly not just for the elderly. Let me go to more callers here, though. Irwin, join us. Hi.
Hi. I'm pulling rank on you. Today's my 77th birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
All right.
Happy birthday.
I think that what we're dealing with really is goes beyond companionship. We're dealing with the inevitability of death. And I think that companionship, just like pets or food or booze or anything else like that, are really the key distractions that we need to keep from facing that inevitability. You know, with the fear of loss of independence, those are the things that make it clear that about the inevitability of it. And I think that all these things that we're talking about, companionship, are distractions, and necessary, essential distractions, but all they are distractions. And I think that slowly, I think you're talking about people who begin to accepting the inevitable, all right?
Irwin, you're quite the existential thinker here.
Well, I got to tell you, there's a great line in Arthur Miller's movie, The Misfits, when Marilyn Monroe is talking about her ex, and they say, well, you seem to like the guy, you know, why did you get divorced? And she said, because while I'm lonely, I want to be alone. You know, but I think that
some people do. Greta Garbo, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but the point I'm making is that all the issue is not loneliness, it's inevitability, and giving in to accepting the inevitability of it. And I live alone. I have companionship. I have lots of things that engage me. But I live in the fear of the fear of loss of tomorrow, of the things that I look forward to, of my independence, and all those kinds of things. Anyway, that's my comment.
Well, thank you for the comment, and happy birthday.
Thank you, sir. You take care now.
Yeah, thanks for the call. And let me go to another caller right away here. Kiara, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. A little muffled, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm off speakerphone. Thank you for taking my call. I think this is such an important topic and underlying so many of the health conditions we're seeing. I'm coming from a different demographic myself, but I hope my question applies really to the population you're really targeting with your study.
You may be a part of it, though, Kiara. Rest assured.
Yeah.
Okay. You may join the ranks.
Well, being, a 40-something person who has had a chronic illness and just being able to get functional again, I really am kind of clawing my own way out of this sense of loneliness and isolation that no one would ever guess looking at me. But because of the condition that I'm healing, I'm really isolated from a lot of people. And my question pertains to, for anybody coming out of this position of isolation and loneliness or enmeshed in it, how can you help, what would your study indicate, or what would you indicate now to advise us to help communicate this? Because if there's a stigma around it and it's embarrassing to ask people to maybe have a 5-minute conversation with you during the day, if you can go a whole day and never have a meaningful conversation, it builds up. And I don't need to elaborate on that, but tools that can help articulate this sense of loneliness and how to not put people off by it, but help them help perspective take and be able to try to meet a lonely person where they're at. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I appreciate you calling in and sharing with us and being someone who's giving a voice to the problem, because you're doing exactly what you're talking about that's difficult. So I appreciate your honesty and bravery in doing that. I think one of the things, you know, I'm a behavioral psychologist, which means that I often look at what is it that's not happening that we wish was happening for someone? And then it doesn't matter so much what we call it, what we name it, but more what is it that we need that we don't have in our lives. So it might be harder to present yourself to people and say, you know, I feel really lonely. And it might be easier to say, I feel like I need more interaction with people. I mean, I, you know, find myself sitting, you know, with friends and we're all on our iPhones and, you know, and I'll say, you know, I need us to have more face-to-face conversation. We all kind of laugh and, you know, I'm not saying I feel lonely in that moment, but I do because I feel disconnected, like we're not having a real connection. So if you can express to people, you know, I'm trying to have more contact with people. I'm trying to, you know, increase the number of people I know well in my life. Again, it's not the number of people, it's the people you know well. I think that that can make a big difference. And again, you don't have to think about finding 10,000 different people to do this with. You just have to figure out a couple of people who really get it and who can really listen and make the difference. But talking about what you need as opposed to needing to put any kind of sort of label or, you know, name on top of it sometimes makes it easier for other people to hold on to.
And Kara, we thank you for the call. And again, Karen Scaltetti is Director of Clinical and Community Services with the Institute on Aging. And got some specific questions here from listeners via email and web and Facebook. William says, could the guest describe in more detail qualities of successful friendship relationships that we as friends, family, and even clinicians can use with lonely persons?
I will let Karen speak a little bit about this, but one thing I wanted to say actually is that we underestimate the importance of listening and hearing and giving the time for that. And I think the last caller and Karen's response were really important in terms of being present and being mindful. And it sounds like common sense, but it's not in this day and age where everyone is on their iPhone and busy. And I'm amazed at when I do take that time in my clinical practice to put down my computer and accept that I'm going to be staying late that day to finish my notes, but I've taken that moment to actually look at my patient in the eye and hear them, how important that is. And that is just specifically in the doctor-patient relationship, but how important it is to actually have that connectivity and have the person heard and know that they are being listened to.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that you're really being heard and that you're really being known and that you can be honest about some of these fears. I mean, even the fear of death that our birthday caller referred to. Do we have honesty in our friendships? Can we talk about the things both that are going really well, but can we talk about the things that aren't going well too? Can we talk about the things we need help with? One of the things we're not good at all in this society and that I myself am not good at. Can we do that with our friends? It's that level of honesty that we're looking for.
Good advice vis-a-vis friendship for any age. But you mentioned hearing before. Eric writes, can your guests provide any advice on how to help a very elderly person who is almost deaf and for whom hearing aids don't help? My 95-year-old father is almost totally withdrawn from us because it is so difficult for him to conduct a two-way conversation. This is making his depression even worse.
Yeah, and I would say again, I'm not sure if the person who wrote in heard about the pocket talker, that I've actually been very surprised at how well they can actually function even when hearing aids no longer work. They are inexpensive. You can purchase them for about $30 on Amazon or any other website, and they actually are quite useful. And again, thinking about other ways of writing, if he's still able to write, or they do have, you know, flashcards with pictures and allow people to communicate in that way.
Pocket talkers just turn up the volume on the speaking, as opposed to hearing aids, which turn up the volume on everything, including background noise. A pocket talker is essentially a microphone you're talking into with headphones. So the only thing that's getting louder is the actual talking that you want the person to hear. So they are cheap and they work tremendously well.
No, that's a very good suggestion. Here's a listener, Arturo, who writes, at 83... conceptual artist making art on computers, I want to be left alone, screening undesirable calls on my landline, giving up my cell phone, responding only to emails from friends from the 1930s to 2011. I walk 3 or 4 miles a day in imitation of Elliot Porter, I'm not sure who that is, who I used to see when younger, stalking Canyon Road and elsewhere in Santa Fe when I was younger, when he would photograph anything that caught his eye. Photographer. I always carry my cameras on my walks. As a former painter, the camera is my notebook and drawing pad. I have many artist friends around the world with whom I am in contact on the web and with whom I collaborate aesthetically. Someone who...
Oh, you were doing quite well.
Yeah, absolutely, like, right. You don't sound like you feel lonely.
doesn't need consultation with Dr. Perry Sinodo.
No, definitely not. And I applaud you for doing so well and sharing that aging can be successful and you can do really well.
And art's another form where people can interact and feel, again, where people can see themselves as meaningful again in a way that if they're having a hard time doing that through conversations or other ways of connecting. We have a youth and arts program that the Institute on Aging runs where we have youth come in and help art and help elderly engage in an art class. And it's amazing how the youth see them in a different light when they're doing art than they do when they're, you know, having a conversation or hearing about their health conditions or that sort of thing. So art's a powerful, powerful tool that lets us express ourselves in a way that we don't have to come up with the right words or the right things to say.
Do you know the name Lillian Rubin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, famed psychologist, author, and good friend of mine who actually, into her 70s, decided to embark on a career of painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually had an exhibit and all that. I thought it was great. Let me get another caller on. Elizabeth, join us. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring to light another organization in the Bay Area called Little Brothers, Friends mm-hmm. of the Elderly. They match volunteers with homebound elders, and they visit them and during the holidays, we prepare like gift bags and, you know, food, Thanksgiving, Valentine's Day, and stuff, so they don't feel so lonely during those times when depression really sets in. So I just wanted to let you guys know there's a chapter in San Francisco. So if anybody out there is interested in volunteering, that's an available option for us Bay Area folks.
Do you have the website address, Elizabeth?
I don't, but if you just type in Little Brothers, it comes up as the first one.
And is there a Little Sisters also, or just Little Brothers?
Not to my knowledge, but...
and I have brothers. I have had patients of mine be the recipients of that program, and it has been something that's highly valued. So thank you.
Yeah, it's been around for...
Oh, it's littlebrothers.org. We just got the website.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, good to hear from you, and let's hear from Magesh. Good morning.
Michael, long-time listener, first-time caller, great show as always. I wanted to make a couple of comments. One, especially coming from India and having stayed here for many years, I see the cultural differences. Mm-hmm. I think in this culture, we try to celebrate the independence beyond a certain point, even as we age, rather than celebrate the healthy interdependence. Mm-hmm. And cultures like in India and China, the older people are part and parcel of the family, the growth of the children, tutoring, part of the community, they're respected. So there are a lot of cultural differences in this culture where after the productive stage of the life is over, I think people feel they're left out. Mm-hmm. And at Wharton, I did a project, and it dealt with older people and some monitoring devices. You won't believe how joyful they were spending an hour or two giving me inputs on the device, partly just to talk. So I feel that we sometimes don't get to the root cause and only see the symptoms. People need to enjoy the aging process and make older people, parents, grandparents, part and parcel of our lives and our children's lives.
Well said, and a good salient point. Thank you for that. I'm sorry, you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say that one of the things we have to do to change this, one of the things that has to shift in this culture for a couple of reasons is the fact that we don't look at people who decide to work with older adults as a brave, amazing, fantastic career. Both Carla and I often get the response of people saying, oh, your work must be very depressing. Nothing could be further from the truth. I feel like I get to work with people who teach me lessons about my life and what's coming next every single day. What an amazing, incredible experience that is. But that's not the way we view it in the society. And we haven't done enough in terms of our and this could be a whole nother show, Michael, I'm sure, but our spending and our choices in the healthcare system enough to say we're going to really make sure that we get people into geriatrics. We're going to help people get interested in that. We're going to make the workforce really decide that that's a career to be proud of. And because of it, we're facing a huge shortage in terms of the number of folks who are ready to work with older adults. And we got to do something about that if we're going to change the messages in our
culture. Talking about cultural attitudes, I mean, really, making not only working with the elderly more rewarding, but making the elderly simply more important, as they should be. You were going to add something, Dr.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that to echo that point? I mean, we have unfilled positions at our clinic at over 60 because we do not have enough physicians who are interested or trained to work with older adults. And in our medical schools across the country, geriatrics education is not a focal point. It is not viewed as being important. Learning about the importance of functional decline in older adults is not a focus, and it is a huge detriment to our future physicians and adults in this country and abroad.
And we go to another caller, and that's you, Andy. Hi.
Hi. My name is Andy Gaines. I'm calling from Ashby Village, and I am so excited that you're bringing this issue of loneliness to the fore, because it feels like there's so much happening, changing right now around the elder culture, people who are growing older but don't perceive themselves as old. There's a whole movement that's developing called the Village Movement that Ashby Village in Berkeley is a part of, that's about people who are aging getting together and creating community and creating ways to support one another as they grow older, so that that loneliness and the impact of that doesn't set in and people can continue living in their communities and supporting the communities.
And you're talking about people of all ages.
Yes. Ashby Village serves people 50 and older, so it really is people who are kind of reaching that latter stage of life. And, you know, the Village Movement is exploring, can they open up to the full, you know, the full community? But actually, we embrace the larger community by having volunteers who are assisting and serving our members, and our members volunteering and serving one another.
All right, Andy, thank you.
Such a great comment and program. One thing I do want to say that reflects back to a comment that one of the listeners called in and said is, you know, aging, there is successful aging, there is not as successful aging, but aging is a varied thing, and some people continue to live independently and some people do have decline, and it's important for us not to dismiss those that are declining. And as we think about how we portray older adults in the media, it's important not to just always picture the healthy older adult, as there are a lot of frail elders in this country.
Let me thank Andy for the call and go to you next. Kay, hi, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to let people know I was terribly depressed. I used to be a San Francisco taxicab driver, and because of multiple sclerosis, I was forced to give that up. And I got into such a terrible situation, I almost became agoraphobic. And then I found Crisis Support Services of Alameda County, and now I'm in a senior support group there, and it's really helping me a lot.
That's terrific.
Can I give the phone number for crisis support?
You can. In fact, I was going to ask you for that, and I want to mention that a number of recommendations have been made in this hour. We'll put them up on our website, which, of course, is kqed.org. Please go ahead, Kay.
Okay, so it's the senior support group of Crisis Support Services of Alameda County, and their phone number is 800-309-2131.
Kay, thank you, Kay.
And also remind people that there is such a thing as paratransit that they can apply for.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up as well. And I'm looking at an email here that says there's a nationwide program. We're giving out a lot of these resources, which is good, called RSVP, Retired Senior Volunteer Program, which is run by various nonprofits in each community and encourages seniors to volunteer. And let's try to get another caller on. Ben, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Thank you guys so much for having this program. I think that it's been a great discussion so far. I am originally from San Jose. I am now living in Orinda. Moved in with my grandmother, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's about 5 or 6 months ago. And I've been taking her to this adult respite care program. And she's been coming home from, when she's there, she seems really active and engaged and glad to be there. But when she comes home, she seems kind of frustrated and doesn't really want to go back again. And it feels to me like she should go because of that social interaction, that it is good for her to just get out of the house and interact with other people. But there's also a little bit of like familial guilt on making her go. Also, I just wanted to hear the guests talk about that.
Ben, how long has she been going?
For 3 months, I think.
Okay. So it's going to take a while, you know, and stick with it. So, you know, social day programs and the Institute on Aging also offers two social day programs similar to what Ben is talking about. Folks with Alzheimer's dementia, you know, the great news is our emotional memory stays around. So, you know, she's probably getting lots of great emotional, good connections. The bad news is the end of the day is the toughest part of the day for folks with Alzheimer's. So at the end of the day, when you pick her up or she comes home, that may be the hardest part of the day. And that might...
You're talking about sundowners.
That's exactly right. And that would be true if she was home with you too, Ben. So, you know, just stick with it. Continue to be positive, you know, and continue to go. And just remember that part of the resistance that you're seeing of her not wanting to go, this is her brain is fighting a really terrible disease, and the disease is going to show up and fight you around some things that could be really beneficial for her. But you sound like you're a great caregiver, and you're going to be able to keep doing the things that are important to her. Social interaction is really, really a key for folks with Alzheimer's, and keeping that progression, you know, kind of as slow as we can. So,
It allows you to continue to be a caregiver so that you don't get caregiver burnout, which is something we see often.
Yeah, and good luck to you, Ben, and thank you for the call. I remember when dementia started setting in my father, you would start singing songs, and there would be people at this elders group that would just sing old songs.
Absolutely.
And suddenly, you know, he would be animated, and it would be a whole different just amazing how things like that can be catalysts. Comment from Lisa. We should start looking, she writes, at using the Internet and many new technologies to keep families connected to remove the loneliness. Mm-hmm. There are things only a family can do, including bringing back cherished memories and improving emotional comfort. Well, thank you both for the work that you do. I think it is very important. And again, there will be a lot of recommendations on our website, kqed.org, that have come through in this hour that you can avail yourself of. And if you want to find out more about the article that Dr. Carla Perry-Sinodo was study lead author on, it is on the Archives of Internal Medicine, which you can find on the web. And again, thank you both for being with us on Forum.
Thanks so much
for having us.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We've got another hour coming up in which we're going to talk to a man who is definitely a legend and up there in years, but still extraordinarily vital and can serve as an example to all of us, and that's Cecil Williams as part of our First Person series. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or make suggestions by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page. And, of course, we welcome ongoing discussion about this hour, Loneliness in Later Years, which you can do on our website, kqed.org/forum, clicking on this segment. Thanks again to Carla Perry-Sinodo and to Karen Scaltetti, and to you, our listeners. And thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.